So, good morning, everybody. Is it still morning? It is. Do you go take a seat? Thank you for braving the water to get to the panel. Philanthropy is not the future of journalism. I'm Nicole Hallway. This is Janet Coates. And our goal really was to have a conversation. We're both in the trenches of this conversation all the time. And we thought it might be helpful to just share some of the realities that we face at a very in-depth level on a regular 24/7 basis and have some discussion. So we hope to leave a lot of time at the end for questions and conversation. And we'll just get started. So I have been at the Beacon. I'm the general manager at the St. Louis Beacon, which is one of the larger nonprofit news organizations that have popped up over the last handful of years. So for the last 4 years, I've been dealing with this question all the time. My background is not in journalism. My background is in digital strategy, marketing, advertising, business development. So that's the lens through which I see this. So as we have this conversation ad nauseum, there are a few terms and things that get bandied about that we just sort of wanted to talk about and maybe not redefine but frame for the sake of this conversation. So we'll start with journalism.
As Nicole said, I'm Janet Coates. I am the CEO of a media consultancy that I run with my husband, Rusty Coates, called Coates to Coates, and there's an inventive name. And as part of my work, I am the New Media Journalism Initiative Manager for the Patterson Foundation in Sarasota, Florida. And Patterson is a relatively young foundation that is making an investment in journalism innovation over a short-term horizon. We're not a long-term funder and we're not a sustaining funder. We are more focused on incubation of some innovative approaches in journalism. So I've come to philanthropy out of a background strictly in for-profit newsrooms in journalism over the last 25 years, and most of the other clients I work with are trying to make a profit. But a lot of my exposure over the last 2 or 3 years has been in the philanthropic area, and it's been an interesting shift to try to understand what some of the expectations both of people who are seeking philanthropic funding and the foundations that are seeking to try to help this space. So that's the perspective I bring to it. Part of the one of the terms that you would think that would be, you know, we could all agree on is journalism and what that means. And of course, that's one of the trickier terms when you're talking about philanthropy and journalism. That's one of the trickier pieces, is what really is journalism? You know, is it, you know, the investigative type of work that is done by the ProPublicas of the world? Yes, that's journalism. Is it also some community-based work that may be more in kind of the community organizing model rather than the traditional journalism model? Yes, that's probably journalism as well. But one of the things that we're finding with funders is that the range of what is journalism really has an impact on defining what the needs are for funding and the needs for sustainability. If you're talking about running an operation like the one Nicole works in, where you've got a staff of, what, 16?
20.
20. Then the question of sustainability and the money that you need to do that is very different than if you're running a two-person shop in Riverhead, New York. So trying to understand along those scale of things and trying to understand what where the best places for philanthropic investment lie is a big piece of the puzzle, I think, that folks are trying to figure out.
So the next term is the public media model. What does that mean? So as a nonprofit journalism organization, people immediately lump us into public media, which I believe to be true in terms of our intent, in terms of why these organizations exist, in terms of the gap we're trying to fill, and the sort of mission-based approach that we take. But when you really look at the public media model, you look at public television. So first of all, there's a television and there's a broadcast channel, which is very different than what the nonprofit news organization has at its disposal. These organizations deliver primarily online, digital first. You also look at same thing with public radio. Public radio has the radio, another broadcast channel, and that's something that these news organizations don't have. They also have a national brand that is over all of them and that is consistent. And a lot of people in local markets, while they have very intimate relationships with their local affiliate, they also have a lot of nationally produced programs or programs produced by other affiliates that they feel an affinity toward alongside their affinity to the local organization. There's no NPR, there's no PBS for digital news. So that's a really big thing to keep in mind. The other thing is staffing. When you look at the staffing of a public radio station or a public TV station, there's staff that does development, there's staff that does events, there's administrative staff, there's staff that runs all the technical aspects. When you look at these nonprofit news organizations, the staff is the majority creating content. That's different. So the idea that also the type of content that's created, a lot of the local public radio stations do news, some of the local TV stations, public TV stations do news, but not all. But these local news organizations primarily are developing local news, and that's all they're doing. So when you start to talk about, well, so you're just going to take the public media model, right? It's not directly translatable. These are all issues that have to be taken into account when these news organizations are looking about how to really move forward.
Yeah, and I would add on to that that, I mean, because we do some work with public media in the consulting work that I do, and you know, a big piece when people talk about using that the public media model is the model that, and it's funny, you talk to public media people, you know, for years it was public media was kind of this, you know, and I know there's some public media people in the room, it was kind of, you know, the Birkenstock and granola crowd and the real power of sustainability, financial sustainability in journalism was the for-profit media. Now everybody kind of looks at public media and says, well, they had it figured out all along. This is a really powerful model, and it's a model that involves deep engagement with audience. And while that's true, it's a model that they've been working on for a long time, and there's a lot of experience and a lot of community goodwill that's built into that. And so when some of the folks who are looking at startup efforts for journalism now, for some of the digitally focused journalism models, you know, it takes time to build those things. Those aren't things that you can just say, okay, you know, we're going to have a membership model. Well, what does that mean? And what's the value of membership? What is the value of that journalism asset in the community that you can translate into a value of membership? So it is a much more complex set of factors than just saying, oh, you know, we'll do a membership model.
Right.
The philanthropy piece, that the nothing is free question. You know, one of the things that I have in working with some of the folks who are doing journalism startups and who are trying to answer the question, should I be for profit or nonprofit? And one of the first things that folks will say is they don't want to be for profit. They don't want to do an advertising model because of the issue of, you know, my advertisers will expect something from me, that there's a trade-off with my journalism credibility. I am here to tell you that foundations expect something from you as well, and that there is no such thing as free money, and there's no such thing as money that does not have expectation attached to it. So the idea that going with a nonprofit model and relying on foundation grants or memberships or other types of philanthropic giving, and that there's no strings attached to that. Talk to some of the folks who have tried to do, who are trying to do nonprofit models, and they'll talk to you about how they have a journalism mission in mind, and then they have an opportunity for funding, but the funder's really interested in healthcare coverage, and that's not something they were planning to do. But now you start trying to, you know, to get to that money that's got that healthcare coverage attached to it. You start to twist yourself into knots. I've had conversations with any number of folks who are doing nonprofit startups who will say that they have to really watch mission creep because there's attractive pots of money out there, but it may require them to do a different journalistic approach than what they had originally in mind. That may be fine, and that may actually be a better approach, but it's not as if this money doesn't come with expectations attached. It also has expectations attached in the form of accountability. And the days of foundations opening up windows and throwing large chunks of money out are gone. I think any conversation that you have with funders, and we just had one in Sarasota a few weeks ago that Patterson put together that had folks from Knight and McCormick and Rockefeller Brothers and Ethics and Excellence in Journalism, so a number of the larger funders in this space. You know, everybody is talking about sustainability, and everybody is talking about accountability, and everybody expects there to be a business plan, and they expect you to live by it. So, you know, the days of going back through your grant and saying, okay, well, you know, here are the things that I tried to check off for my grant are done, and much more of the foundation funding is being done iteratively. So instead of giving you a 3-year grant for something, you may be getting funding by the quarter. There is much more of a business model approach coming from foundations, and I expect that that is only going to increase. There is not, it's often been said, there's not enough foundation money out there to fund the journalism that we need to serve communities, and that's absolutely true. I think the last few years, there's been a lot of money in the space. There have been a lot of new players come into the space, and I represent one of them. And there's been a lot of experimentation with money, and I think that we are at a place now where a lot of the funders are looking at it and saying, okay, what have we actually accomplished? I've heard others of my peers in the foundation world say that there's been a lot of funding of activity and not a lot of funding of capacity. And I think that that is really shaping how funders are looking at the money that they put into the space now. What is the actual capacity that we're building here as opposed to creating journalism activity? What are the pieces of the puzzle that we're doing that are actually building the capacity for this journalism to sustain itself? When we talk about sustaining, you know, one of the things that's kind of gotten thrown out the window because journalism startups have been happening in such a troubled time for journalism and for things like local advertising, you know, a lot of the ratios that would normally come into play with funders around what is sustainable have kind of, those have kind of been put to the side. But if you talk to foundations, many of them will tell you that what they consider to be a sustainable effort, a sustainable project that they're funding, whether it's in journalism or healthcare or anything else, that sustainability looks something like 30% of philanthropic funding and 70% of earned revenue. And if you start thinking about it in those terms, if foundations start to apply that kind of math to journalism funding, then a lot of people who have started things up in the last few years are going to be applying for PR jobs somewhere because they are not anywhere close to that 70% of earned revenue, and they don't really have the thinking or the business model to get there. So even if philanthropic funding is a key piece of your revenue plan, and it may well be, and that may be appropriate, it still is not 100% of your revenue plan, and in truth, it shouldn't be 50% of your revenue plan. So that is, you know, when you're thinking about what the foundations and the funders are looking at, that's a piece of the math that I don't think many journalism startups are taking into account, that I had better be figuring out how to get myself to a point where no more than 30% of my money is coming in from foundation grants. And I guarantee you from the surveying we've done of the space, that there, we're a long way from a number like that.
And I'll speak for the Beacon has received the bulk of its funding from local foundations. And so therefore, we're kind of blessed that we can have our funders sitting at our table during strategic planning and a lot of touch points, a lot of real close conversation with our funders. And even our local funders who are very much about the need for us in the space and the need for the type of reporting that we produce are asking these same questions. They're pushing for these same metrics around how we're bringing in our money, what are we doing to not need to come ask them for any more soon. So it's a very real thing both nationally and locally. And so we sort of covered a little bit of this previously, but this idea of a business model, everybody says, well, what's your business model? And people have answers around around grants, around ad sales, around different types of efforts. But beyond the what is really underneath the how and the why. And a business model, however you're going to define it, is about scalability. It's about sustainability, that you can exist, and it's replicable and repeatable, and it's something that doesn't just let you tread water, that allows you to grow. And I think that a lot of us in the space, when asked what our business model is sort of an answer to how are you going to keep going, and less about how are you going to grow. This need for the type of reporting that we're providing for our communities is not going to diminish. It's not going to sort of stay at this entry level that we're able to start to provide it. People are naturally, if we're doing our job right, going to want more, and we're going to want to be able to scale, and we need to be thinking about how to do that.
Metrics. This is the dirty word of journalism, no matter what side of journalism you're in, is the idea that we actually need to keep count of what it is we're doing. And I think this is a piece, as someone who came out of a traditional newsroom, you know, I spent many, many years in rooms listening to people say, well, we don't need to pay attention to single copy, and we don't need to pay attention to those numbers because, you know, the good we do in the world is about the change we make with our journalism, not the fact that we were able to, you know, have this bump in single copy because we had the lotto on the front that day. One of the things that we found in working both with the folks that I'm working with at Patterson that we're helping to fund and helping to drive some of their innovation, but also with some of the clients that we work with, is that people just don't know what to count. And they're spending a lot of time counting the wrong things. I've had a number of conversations with folks who were running startups who were talking about the need to build their audience and the need to drive their audience numbers up. And the more we looked at their business numbers, we said, if you drive your audience up, you're going to kill your business because you can't sustain a larger audience. What you need to be spending time on is figuring out how to convert the audience you have into revenue. How do you make that audience pay? We have the conversation about, you know, who is your audience, and you know, there's the business case model will tell you that your audiences are the people who pay you for your work. That is often a difficult conversation to have with journalism folks because they don't like the idea of the influence that might imply. But the need to put in place not just audience metrics but very strong business metrics, to be looking at creating things like customer relationship management tools to track the people that you're actually touching, not just with your journalism, but from a revenue standpoint. These are important pieces of not just the business sustainability case, but also if you are going after philanthropic funding. You know, the foundation I work with wants to see those kinds of numbers. They want to see those kinds of metrics about not just who are you reaching with audience, but, you know, how are you starting to try to convert that into a piece of your revenue model. One of the things that we recently did, we surveyed in some of the work that I've done, I've been part of a couple of surveys of community-level startups. So these are very hyper-local types of startups. And we've done that survey in a couple of different formats. And then I just recently participated with the Investigative News Network to do a survey of both INN sites, which are all nonprofits, and a mix of community sites that were both for-profit and nonprofit. And when you start to look at some of the metrics that are in place about their business, you start to get a really cold chill up the back of your neck. One of the things that has consistently come through is that when we ask them to break down their budgets, what are they spending money on? Between 60 and 70% of their budgets are spent on content generation. They typically spend between 12 and 15% on technology, and what's left goes towards the idea that they need to make money. And there is just absolutely no way that a budget model where you're spending 60% of your money at minimum on creating content and only spending maybe 15%, to 20% of your money on sales, on development, on seeking forms of revenue. This is so top heavy that the fact that it's even standing at this point kind of amazes me. Having people look at keeping track of where they're actually putting not just their time but their money is a huge indicator towards whether they're creating something that actually might sustain. So on that point, I think one of the points that Nicole and I are trying to drive home in this conversation and that we've really come to in the couple of years that we've been talking about it is that philanthropy definitely has a role in journalism. But I'm spending way too much of my time talking to people who believe that it is a primary funder for journalism. And there's just the math just will not hold that up, either from a foundation standpoint or from a journalism enterprise standpoint. The idea that philanthropic funding should be the biggest piece of your sustaining revenue is just math that won't work. I think there are a couple of conversations going on within philanthropy and journalism that are important ones to think about in this context. One is, are there types of journalism that just can't be sustained any other way? And we get into these conversations. I've been part of several of them lately, that there are some types of journalism that are so confrontational or so unpleasant in their subject matter that you just can't draw financial support any other way but through a philanthropic model. I'm not entirely convinced that that's true, but if it is, then all the more reason that we better be figuring out what other revenue models will work for the other forms of journalism, because if there are going to be forms that we just can't support any other way, and they tend to be the really unpleasant kind for people to have to be confronted by, then we need to start trying to figure out how we move more of that money in that direction. I think the other piece of conversation that's going on is how much should foundations be shifting more towards a venture capital model as opposed to the traditional philanthropic model? And I think you see a lot of foundations testing this idea. Certainly Knight has been very open about the idea that they're testing pieces of that and that they are reexamining the way that they are that they've been funding journalism. I think this is generally the conversation that's going on among a lot of foundations is, should the role of philanthropy in journalism be less about sustaining or less about enabling technological development, which has been a big piece of how philanthropy has moved in journalism? And should it be more about capacity building? Should it be more about let's help people figure out business methodology that will really work for them, that can help them, you know, the whole teach a man to fish approach? Is there a way to start moving philanthropic funding in that direction?
So clearly there's something that's working. There's stuff that's working because the organizations are out there. We're reporting news. We're still around for the moment. People are making some strides in figuring out alternative revenue streams. You know, for the Beacon, and for this I'll speak for the Beacon, only that we really look at, we've always from the beginning looked at the need for alternative revenue streams because our editorial team is very, very staunch in their position that they don't want to feel like there's any sort of influence, which any journalism team would be. So I see it as my challenge to try to find possibly revenue streams that are outside of our core product, but that build off of skills that help us make our core product. So that's technology, that's investigation or research, or the gathering and delivering of information, that's a relationship with the community. All of those things are assets that we can look at other products that we might be able to bring in revenue on that don't rely directly on the content. Let Janet talk a little bit about some of what's working in the smaller organizations.
Sure.
First.
A big piece of what the foundation I work with has been focused on have been the real hyperlocal, so the very community-oriented sites. And we've worked with the group that's come together through Block by Block, which has been a session that's a summit that we've had the last couple of years, and we'll have again in Chicago this fall. Right now, we've put together a program that we're piloting with 12 of these small community publishers. That's an entrepreneurial boot camp, for lack of a better word, where we are spending a significant amount of time and resources in giving these folks personal business mentoring. So it's not been, let's bring a whole group of people into a hotel room for 3 days and teach them how to do a spreadsheet and send them back out into the world and think we've given them business skills. What we've been trying to do is, we did bring them all into a hotel room, but it was to do a actual real business plan. It was to build, it was to create an exit strategy, which, if you want to talk about something that's controversial and confrontational with a group of journalism entrepreneurs, bringing them into a room and telling them the first thing you want them to do is create their exit strategy was a mind blower. How are you going to get out of this? Because you are probably going to have to get out of this at some point in time. What's your preferred way? What's your kind of your route towards exit? Having them build a business plan, and then we've had them attached to a business mentor for a year who spends time with them on the phone every week, and who also goes to their markets and spends, you know, goes and visits local advertisers with them, goes through their CRM with them, and helps them, you know, refine their business practice. In doing this, we picked some folks that we thought had pretty good business models and a pretty good shot at sustainability, and we've been at this for about 6 months now, and one of the things that we're finding is that for the small business, for these small hyper-local sites that truly operate as a small business, so, you know, it's kind of the mom-and-pop shop model of journalism, that there absolutely is a path to sustainability for those folks. That there is that what we're trying to help them create is a path towards financial sustainability and the opportunity to take a day off, which would be a huge benefit for these folks. In fact, one of the people we're mentoring told us when we reported out their 100-day progress, he said, "My biggest piece of progress is that I spent a couple of hours in my garden on Sunday, and I have not done that since I started the site." Part of what is working among these folks is the realization that if they're running a community news site, they really are a local business person, and trying to help shift their mindset from just I'm in the journalism business to I'm a local business person too, and that it's about building relationships with local businesses, which are relationships that take a great deal of time to tend. And if you're spending all of your time on the journalism, then you're not spending enough time on the relationship piece. So within the hyperlocal space, we definitely see that there's nothing new here. It's stuff that community newspapers have done for years. It's stuff that all small business people do in maintaining relationships and cultivating a client base. But journalists don't have the experience and the skills to do that. So a piece of what we see is an opportunity to create some programs that will help provide that learning for those local publishers, because it's certainly not been a question in our experience with the dozen that we've experimented with in this pilot program. It's certainly not been a question of once we show them this is the best way to do this that there's a lack of enthusiasm for doing it. And we have seen definite improvements in financial results among those folks. So, you know, while many folks will say there's, you know, the truism that, you know, there's no business model in local, well, there may not be any business model in a network of local sites that you try to sell nationally. I'm not optimistic about that piece of it, but there definitely is a model for local community news. And it's really a question of execution on that. I think the places that I have more concern are thinking about folks who are in Nicole's shoes, the more regional level folks and the investigative folks who are not really focused on building those community. Well, you all are, but the investigative folks in many cases aren't really focused so much on building community relationships as they are, you know, pursuing certain types of journalism. We are getting ready to try to replicate the business training program that we've done with the block-by-block sites, which has been a mix of both for-profit and nonprofits. We're talking with Investigative News Network now about how can we take what we've learned about business development with these community sites and now try that with the investigative news sites as well, because we're pretty convinced that the differences between for-profit and my business partner and husband says all the time that, you know, that nonprofit is a tax status, not a business model. And we think that there is a lot of opportunity to take what we're learning with the hyperlocals about how to execute on a business model and then try it with the investigative news piece of it as well. It's different, certainly some different sources of revenue and some different issues that they'll have to confront, but the methodology is not dissimilar.
So regional, and again, I'll speak just for the Beacon. I'm going to tweet a report that Michelle McClellan did for the Knight Foundation that sort of covers a lot of the other larger news orgs. But talking about what's been working for us, it's really sort of a large-scale version of the small business model of being a community business that's out in the community. We always talk about being more than a website. We do a lot of offline events. I believe that philanthropy in terms of individual donations, even larger donations, will always be a piece of our puzzle. I believe that our projections are at about 30% because there's a relationship building that happens when you give to something. But when we look at how to develop those relationships, we take this advocacy approach where we understand that it's a long tail. We understand that there are multiple touches that go in front of somebody converting to a donor or a partner or a sponsor. But we feel like that work up front, especially since we don't at this point plan to ever hire a department of fundraisers, is going to sustain itself better. If we build a real relationship with them and we have things in place where we can touch them as part of our everyday business or every month business with our ongoing events and such, that they can, it'll be a less intensive relationship to giving than it would be if it was based around a fund drive or a transactional sort of donation. So we're really looking at building real relationships. Events has been really successful for us. We've sort of outperformed our projection on events every year. But I have to be honest, that has to do with one of our founders who's basically an impresario, and he can throw an event like nobody's business, so I don't necessarily call that replicable. But we have been very successful with that, and that is, again, about relationships. We did a lot of work in the beginning, almost accidentally, with a communication strategy firm. They're called Act Three. And we went to them asking for some pieces or a website or some project we were working on, and they kept asking us, well, why? Why do you feel that's what you need? Why do you feel that that's what you want? And we ended up on this thing they call a framing process, where we all sat around the table, the journalists, the business people, and really talked about what we were there to do. And that work sort of led us to really understand that before we were doing journalism, or the reason that we were doing journalism, was to help St. Louis be a better informed, more equipped community. And putting that first, I think, and having that filter has really sort of shaped a lot of the decisions that we've made. We did a non-traditional partnership with the History Museum and spent a year doing events and coverage around race in St. Louis. And St. Louis is an infamously divided, some would say, city. So it's an issue that a lot of people thought we were crazy for wanting to talk about for a year. But the first event we had at the History Museum had about 400 people show up, and everybody remarked, this is the most integrated crowd I've ever seen at an event in St. Louis. So, like, that's a win. It doesn't hit our bottom line directly, but it's a win. So having being open to those sorts of things has been a real plus to us. We also have started to, we've had a CRM in place since the beginning. We use Salesforce for customer relationship management, and we've really started to try to develop a process, not just for me and my assistant and the bookkeeper, but for everybody in the organization about how those relationships track from casual reader, from somebody who came to an event to somebody who becomes a donor or somebody who becomes a sponsor or partner. So really understanding the process around that evolution and doing it in a way that doesn't feel like we're actively converting people, but more that we're helping them build a relationship and giving them options for engagement. It's a subtle difference, but in terms of our mission and the reason we're there, we don't want to approach it in a we want to convert you sort of way. It really needs to be understanding the process and sort of offering people those ways in. But consistently we've seen that we did a campaign last year called Back the Beacon, and we engaged people by asking them some questions about St. Louis, and then at the end asking them why they backed the Beacon, why the Beacon was important to us. And the return was about the same as our direct mail campaign, but some interesting things came out of that. We did a targeted message specifically to our heaviest readers, people who asked us to send them an email every day and clicked on it every day. And we did a specific ask to them, and the return was zero. None of them gave. I did a personal mailing campaign, and our editor Margie did a personal campaign, and mine outperformed the general campaign, I think, by 2 or 3 times, and hers by 4 or 5 times. So that personal ask, again, not replicable. It was about us asking, and both of those also brought in more new households than any of the other type of asks. But it's something to know about how that direct relationship and how that direct touch converts versus this sort of mass, hey, you should give to us because we're important, message does. So that's some of the stuff that's working for us.
The idea that there is a model out there, I think, has been one of the things that has hurt the effort to try to figure out what will work on the sustainability standpoint. And I think it's one of the things, bringing it back to the issue of philanthropy, I think it's one of the issues that has been kind of an undercurrent in among those who are seeking philanthropic funding is, we all look at what has gotten money, and we say, okay, that got money, so they must want that. They must want a version of that. That must be where they're putting money. So I need to create the next version of that. And I think that the result has been that we kind of wind up chasing after things that have already been figured out to some extent instead of innovating and trying some new things. And we can also chase some things right into the end of the alley with the brick wall. Not everything that a foundation funds is going to be successful. And in fact, I would argue that one of the things that foundations need to do a better job of is exposing the failures instead of taking them out behind the building in the deep dark of night and burying them in a shallow grave. We need to talk about what didn't work, because that's how we learn about what might work the next time. Maybe this was not a bad idea. Maybe it was executed poorly. This search, the elusive search for a model, I think is, there isn't one. There's as many models as there are communities and there are approaches. That said, I think there are some commonalities that are starting to emerge that we need to think about when we're thinking about journalism startups, either as for-profits or nonprofits. One of the conversations I mentioned that we had a group of funders in Sarasota back in the middle of February, just to talk, we weren't talking about funding any particular thing. We were just talking about the whole issue of sustainability and what we see. And we also brought some publishers into the room as well. They were, so it was, looking at it from both sides. One of the things that became abundantly clear from the beginning of our conversation is that we did not have a common definition of what sustainable is. That's one of those words that gets tossed around out there. Let's make the list, and I'm going to use them all in this section. Sustainable, engagement, all those words that get thrown around that we don't really know what they mean. And we wound up spending a good bit of one morning just talking as funders, what do we mean when we say sustainable? And there are implications in that conversation around. So for some people, it was that ratio, 70% earned, 30% philanthropic. For some people, it was, I need to see some kind of forward momentum for the project that I'm enabling. Well, okay, well, what does forward momentum mean? Well, it's like pornography, I know it when I see it, kind of things. But talking about, you know, the measurements for that. Some people talked about, you know, we need to look, and I think this is really starting to get at the issue of you know, what are those enduring ideas that we all need to be thinking about, that if we're looking for momentum, we're looking for momentum around creating an audience for your content. So creating a venue, a group of people who will come to you every day and click on the email every day, people who follow you and rely on you for content. Seeing some forward momentum on engagement and defining what that means. What is it that you want people to do with this content that you are creating? Do you want them to, you know, write letters to the city council? Do you want them to, post your link in their social channels? Do you want them to come to an event? Do, you know, what is the activity that you are trying to enable through the content? So setting up the measures to track that. And then you have to see some momentum around revenue and setting up the measures to track that as well. And I think Ben Wurz from the Knight Foundation who said, you know, if you've got two of the three of those, then we can help you with a third. But if you come to us and say, okay, I've got this great idea, but I don't really have an audience, I'm not got much engagement, I have no idea how to make money, then, you know, you probably need to go back to the starting point. But so a piece of the model, I think, is understanding that we do have to track the interactions we're having, and that has to go beyond Twitter followers and uniques, and it has to go with what's happening to the content after you create it. What are people doing with it? My friend Joey Mayer at the University of Missouri has made a study of engagement and tried to pin down that very mushy term to talk about what that looks like in practice. And, you know, a lot of what she's talking about is that action on the content. And it's going to the conversation instead of trying to create it all the time yourself. So, you know, the metrics piece of tracking what happens with your content, the need to have a CRM in place so that you're actually tracking your interactions with the people who are giving you money, and you're keeping track of that in a way beyond, you know, a list in your head, that you're actually tracking those interactions. The need to have a business plan, and the fact that there are a lot of people out there who are running businesses right now who do not have one. And there are a lot of people, some of the folks that we've been working with in some of the efforts we've been making on business literacy and business mentoring, there are a number of folks who are running pretty financially successful businesses with their sites who didn't have a budget and had never made one. And it was, you know, kind of this moment of, well, you know, I really am a business. And in fact, one of the folks that we were working with said, you know, this is kind of this confrontational moment of realizing that, you know, this is not just my little journalism site, that this really is a business and I have to treat it as such. So the need to have those business accountability tools, I think, is a universal piece of the model. The need to have that CRM, the need to have a budget, the need to think about an exit strategy. What's going to happen here? What is your best case scenario and what's your worst case scenario? Those are the things, rather than looking for a model that we can, that this is what funders want to see and you should try to do that, or this is what is successful, looking for the practices that help you create that level of accountability so that you can measure yourself, and when you're going to a funder or an advertiser, you have the measurements that can make your case that, yes, this is an investment worth making.
One of the things that we did at the Beacon was a couple of years ago, and we were really struggling with this, is I came up with something that I call Beaconomics, which I actually stole from one of our reporters who was reporting on economics, but it worked. And we looked at sort of like what our assets were, like what were the things that made us that were important. And we identified access, accountability, focus, influence, and trust. And then what are the exchanges that we create the opportunity for? Acknowledgement, context, cross-comfort interaction, data, familiarity, public awareness. And then we talked about, like, what are the ways that we make these things happen? How do we make these things go? And we looked at our barroom conversations, our events, Facebook, email. And then what are the values? What are the currencies that we have? And so common vocabulary, evangelism, jobs, relationships, revenue, those are all currencies. And then what we've been doing since then has been trying to figure out how to, so being able to articulate that sort of value structure, we can then try to tie those to conversion efforts and tie those things to the bottom line. So those are all very mushy things, but that's what's important. Somebody coming away from one of our events saying, I lost my program director yesterday in this program that helps underprivileged teens learn a skill through the arts and get a job, and they get paid while they get trained. That's a very important asset. Having her say, oh, I came to one of your events and I met somebody who I never would have met before, and I hired her the next day and she wrote a grant. We just got new funding for next year. So that's a really big success story for a community. And it uses all of those things that I just articulated, but it doesn't necessarily translate to, you know, the cash register closing. But that's our challenge, to try to figure out how to take those mushy measures and really tie them to the bottom line. We have about 15 minutes. I want to get to questions, so we'll just breeze through some of the things that we think are trends that are really important for this hyperlocal and regional. There are a ton of panels about this topic, so I'm not going to go too deep into it, but the idea that everything is local, and that local doesn't necessarily anymore mean geography. It means where I went to school, what my interests are, where I spent my formative years. It means what I think it means when I think it means it. And so sort of letting go of the idea that it's all about geography for these organizations. They're nimble and new, and they have the opportunity to sort of embrace the ideas and shift toward them in a way that some larger organizations have trouble with. So an example of that really quickly, and I'll tweet this, is a video that we put together on diabetes. We did a series of reports about health disparities in St. Louis, and worked with a firm to put together an animated video that really articulated how healthcare issues affect a city, and it's specific about St. Louis, but the way it frames it was very important to people studying diabetes and social impact to health issues everywhere. And we've had a lot of people from around the country contact us about it.
Okay. Relationships. That's what we mean by this, that everything, you know, no matter what you're doing, if you are running a business, no matter your tax status, everything is about relationships. And the piece that journalists who are running new journalism organizations have to make sure they're doing is that they're tracking those relationships, and they're creating those relationship maps, understanding how you use that for prospecting, how you use that for, you know, proof of concept of what you're doing. That is the key piece, is not treating that casually, but treating that very rigorously and very scientifically.
And then fail forward fast. Everybody's talking about this. Don't be afraid to try something and not have it work out. We had a guy come in who does market analysis and helps people who make widgets find new opportunities for their widgets. And we were like, this isn't going to work because he works with widgets and we don't do widgets. But we dug in. And we identified a couple silos of reporting that we might be able to turn into consulting opportunities or be conveners of conversations around. One of them was around diversity, and we partnered with some people to come up with a corporate diversity offering, because one of the things the guy identified is that corporations are still spending money on diversity. And it turned out that we didn't have the resources to fully invest in the development of the product, but the product went on and is now being considered by three large corporations. So we're ultimately not going to be a part of it, but that tells us that that idea is not a dumb one. That idea is something we might pursue again in a different topic when we have different resources to put toward it. But know what, be able to, like Janet was saying, don't take the failures out back. Learn from them what you can take on to the next thing, and don't hold on to things that are clear aren't working. Multidisciplinary.
Yeah.
So this is just basically people who have different perspectives at the table is an asset. A lot of these organizations have been started by journalists who have been in their careers and have intellectual knowledge of their region that's unparalleled. But having people at the table who come from different backgrounds is key. Technology is not an option anymore. It's something that's a part of any business. So paying attention to it in that way is crucial to survival and thriving versus treading water. So as many people as you can get at the table in your leadership team that have different perspectives and really give them a seat is going to give you a better chance. So in summation, yes, I think that philanthropy has a place. I think that the relationship built through giving and the conversation around ownership in a community is very important. But I believe it has to be a piece of a larger picture in terms of how journalism moves forward when it comes to community information.
Yeah, and I just the last thing I would say about that is I think when we look at philanthropy as being a key piece, you know, as being the major piece of funding for journalism moving forward, we're missing the opportunity to tell our own story. And I think one of the things that has been shocking for some of the folks that we've worked with is that when they tell their own story, their own business story effectively, people give them money, whether it's an advertiser or it's a donor, and that people have been, we have been undervaluing our content because we've been kind of reluctant to put a price on it. And every single person that we've worked with where we've said, okay, you know, you need to actually ask for a little bit more, they've been able to make that conversion. So just saying, okay, I'm just going to default to, I'm going to put together the grant, I'm going to look to philanthropic funding because I'm not sure I can make a business case for this. There's a business case to be made for, there is value in what we do, and we need to assert that and ask for it.
Own your value proposition.
Yes.
So questions, the mic is right here. If you could come up to the mic, that'd be great.
I'm Bill Adair, the editor of PolitiFact. Wanted to see if either of you could talk about membership with new startups and community news organizations. Where has that worked? Why has it worked? Where has it failed? Sort of lessons of that.
I'll speak again just for the Beacon. We have had good success with that concept, and we've sort of gone back and forth between the language around it because we don't necessarily want to confuse people about being members of the site, and that's something we want people to be able to do for free, and we've sort of settled on the language individual donor. I think a lot of our individual donors have come from the advocacy approach, people who have relationships with the founders, people who have relationships with people who are have been writing in the region for a long time, and then or topics that we're covering that are important to them and that sort of expanding out. I think a lot of it has come in through the events that we have on a regular basis. I think that when I talk about where philanthropy has a piece, I think that's the biggest piece. I think having the more people who feel like they own a piece and really understand and have a relationship with you and can spread that, I think that's invaluable, whatever you label it.
Yeah, the two points that I would build off of, Nicole, is it's either got to be there's a particular cause or subject, the advocacy piece. There's something that you're able to appeal to their desire to and help, you know, one-winged ducks in your community or whatever. And then there is the insider piece and, you know, the power of being an insider. And there has to be a value add for that. It can't just be, oh, I'm in the gold circle for PolitiFact or whatever. There's got to be some asset of membership that you're creating, and you really need to spend some time thinking about what that asset is, because it may not be what you think it is. I think you have to do some research, spend some time with folks about what they would see as an asset of membership, because it may be quite different from what you would think as a journalist.
And the more you can tie that to your product, the better.
Yeah.
I mean, a discount card is a discount card, but, you know, there are coupons everywhere. If it's something that builds their relationship with you, that's a double score.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Ulrike. I'm a foreign correspondent based in Seattle. There are some efforts now being undertaken to put entrepreneurial journalism, to strengthen that, for example, at Jeff Jarvis, Tell Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism, or the work David Cohen is now doing with Three Hyperlocals in Berkeley. But I was amazed to learn that just now, a year before their funding is stopping, they're finally learning to do a little more than Google Ads.
Yeah.
So my question is, should the thinking, where will the money come from? Who needs a product that you're putting out, and who will pay for it? Should that be instilled in journalism education just as much as reporting or learning to interview these essentials?
Yes, 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 and yes. I mean, I think that the schools and the folks at CUNY and Jeff Jarvis, their efforts there, I think, are remarkable, and that kind of thinking needs to be happening. Part of what I am not going to be in the, I am not a foundation person, and I'm not going to be working with foundations for forever. But part of what we're trying to push at Patterson is let's experiment with some ways to teach this, and then let's learn from it, and let's look at funding as capacity building opportunity. You know, one of the conversations that we were really trying to enable when we pulled the funders together was, you know, how do we create funding opportunities that will be focused on the business literacy piece and the business skills development piece. These folks do not need grants to help them do the journalism, and I think most funders understand that now. I don't think there's a lot of disagreement among the foundation world about that. And I think we're coming to a realization that foundation funding for technology development is perhaps not the best use of funds, that the technology development will happen on its own, and that building proprietary technology in an open source world is perhaps not the best use of dollars. But this does have value. The ability to teach people how to run a business and how to value their content and how to extract the value of their content, that's something that can create sustainable businesses. So the more I think more and more funders are thinking that way. We're certainly trying to enable that thinking through some strategic investments we've made at Patterson. And you know, I think there's a growing sense that that's really where the opportunity lies. I think we've got one more, maybe.
Hi, I'm a different David Cohen. I run a firm called Minerva.
Do you have to say that a lot?
Yeah, more often than I wish. I wish my parents had gone in a different direction.
Yeah. But,
anyway, we're investors in a lot of what we call media companies that were traditionally for-profit and maybe are a little less so now. And when I hear you talk about the need for capacity creation, I sort of look at my world and I scratch my head and I say there's excess capacity in the historically for-profit media world. And I wonder whether the St. Louis Beacon sounds like a wonderful enterprise, but I wonder whether there needs to be entrepreneurial energy devoted to creating new organizations, or whether there's a model which basically arbitrages the existing for-profit model and uses those legacy assets become more of a community organization.
Right. Yeah, we often talk about, you know, the fact that our business may need to look very different. We may spin off some for-profit entities. We may partner with other entities to make a different for-profit entity. Whether or not the actual money-making happens in our structure versus next to it, I think it's sort of the wild, wild west in terms of the business structure and in terms of the opportunities for different types of organizations to come together. But I think that there's definitely some synergy there that will probably emerge out of necessity in the future.
I'm Tom Stites. I'm the president of the Banyan Project, which is devoted to finding and making real a real sustainable business model that is replicable from community to community. And right now, the model that we've developed over 3 years is based on the sturdy foundation of consumer cooperative ownership, so that readers own their community information source the way that depositors own credit unions and shoppers own food co-ops. We have the support of the national community, the National Cooperative Business Association, and are building a pilot project now. A pilot co-op is being formed as we speak in Haverhill, Massachusetts, which is an old shoe manufacturing town like St. Louis, but isn't anymore and is a news desert. Mm-hmm. So I just want people to know that it's not just for-profit or non-profit.
Correct. Right.
There is
right.
a third sector yes. called the cooperative sector.
Yeah.
I've written three pieces, if you would care to look at them, for the Neiman Journalism Lab that lay this out, mm-hmm. that have gotten like 500 tweets in it, or people are paying attention. And I don't want to be the only person who's working on this. I'm here to advocate for the mm-hmm. idea that it's too soon to give up on the idea that there is not a sustainable, replicable business model, and that it may be that there is more than one form
Absolutely.
Of sustainable,
yes.
replicable model
yep.
within the cooperative world.
Yep.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. I think we've made
I think we're time.
It to one. I'm getting the 1 minute signal. So.
Does anybody have a 1 minute question? He was a blind
yes,
before.
Yes,
1 minute.
You were talking a little bit about what I'll call a double bottom line, the social return on
right.
investment,
mm-hmm.
as long as aside with the financial. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Are there any kind of standard that are emerging in this social return on investment piece? As you're talking about it?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think there's some patterns. Last year at South by Southwest, Google was talking about releasing some analytics around the social return on investment and trying to help tie that, and I have heard nothing about that since last year. So Google's trying to figure out and hasn't. No, I think there are a lot of people researching that and talking about that, but I would love to stumble upon that and, you know, discover something new, but I don't know of anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.